listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-GM,
McGill, but this time, I'm not a GM.
Ah, Dangus Mangus, he got me.
That's right, I'm a referee.
Huh. There's games that have a referee. Several. This is episode 187 being recorded on the 27th of March, 2024. McGill, you are a referee today.
That's right. And that's because on my side of the show, where the RPG Danger Room, where we take a look at a variety of RPG systems and resources and things, and if they inspire us, we test drive them. Over in the RPG Danger Room, I'm actually doing a bit of a sampler platter, as it were. I'm covering a lot of little things, but the umbrella under which they all exist is they're all from a publisher on Itch called Highland Paranormal Society, and Highland Paranormal Society is run by someone named Nate Treme. It may be Treme, it's T-R-E-M-E, which I know as Treme from, you know, the place in New Orleans is called Treme. So I'm looking at a whole bunch of Nate Treme games, and many of the ones I have looked at in researching this use a referee in place of a GM.
Well, there you go. McGill, I feel like around the time this episode is coming out, this may become relevant, so I'm just going to go out and say it. I am getting an account. I've set up an account on startplaying.games.
Yeah, that's right. You were sort of foreshadowing that on previous episodes.
I am planning to run a game. Hopefully I will sort of have done a bit of testing for it and, gotten the ball rolling by the time this episode comes out. But, look out for that. Listener, if you want to play a game with Tom Lando, Tom Lando is going to be running Wicked Ones, but a sort of modified take on Wicked Ones, almost towards the Valiant Ones mod that they have in the rules, but not quite. It's Rebellious Ones, and it is a story of heroes rising up in a region torn in war between two major factions. And you go out and you sabotage those major factions and you protect the people from their oppression. And very excited to see what people elect these factions to be. Could be anything from, you know, a rampaging horde of orcs to a technologically advanced society of elves that are, like, imperialist. Or it could be, like, you know, could be aliens. Could be zombies.
I'm really curious just to hear how this all shakes down, your start playing experience, what kinds of players you sort of net have with a site or a service like that, and then, of course, how the game goes. This is all very intriguing.
My thinking is that for this first game, as I'm, like, just dipping my toes in, I'm going to set it, like, quite cheap. It's as appealing as possible because there's only one person running Wicked Ones right now, and they have their game's almost full up. So I figure there must be some demand, and if I swoop in there with like a real bargain game just to gather some reviews and whatnot, that'll kick things off real good.
For sure, while also sort of doing your own spin on it.
True. I also don't have, like, I don't know. I I guess I could have like I could get some like free music and stuff and like put that together, but like that's built into Roll 20. I could do that, but you know, I'm you know, your game doesn't have music, you know? And I feel like mainly I'm going to want to focus on like just nailing that theater of the mind sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't tend to do music on Roll 20 because I find it's a lot more difficult to sort of balance all the audio levels when you're doing it remotely. Like, I like to use music if I'm running a game in person, but then I can just sort of tweak the volume control so that it's comfortable for everybody. Whereas online, everybody has their own volume controls and everybody's got to sort of mess around with it.
So you hooked me up with Dungeon Draft, which I'm going to be using, same as your Wicked Ones game. I'm going to be using this to design the player's base, whatever that may be. And then I was happy to see that when I logged into the Roll 20 for your Wicked Ones game today and saw that it was on the dungeon page, and I was able to like analyze it and sort of reverse engineer it in my head to see how you made it in Dungeon Draft. I am also, for the region map, I sort of randomly generated and then slightly tailored a map using something called ProcGen Arcana. Have you ever heard of this?
No, that's a, is this a, like an AI generator?
No, it is, I don't think so anyways. I think it's like kind of pre-AI, because it is just like procedural generation. Just like you don't, you put in, you can click like a few tags and then it like generates a random map, probably from like a seed or something, to like that fits the tags that you put in. ProcGen Arcana actually has a number of generators. The one I'm specifically talking about is the Realm Generator. Listeners can look up ProcGen Arcana. It is hosted on wadaboo.github.io.
So. Tom, that's really funny.
What's that?
That's really funny because one of the things I'm going to mention is a particular wadaboo.itch.io generator, the one-page dungeon generator.
Oh, hey, that is part of ProcGen Arcana.
Well, there we go.
And
on itch, on the Wadaboo itch, the only ProcGen thing they mention, like specifically, is there's a ProcGen mansion, but I didn't realize that the one-page dungeon was part of it.
Yeah, if you go to wataboo.github.io, wataboo.github.io, you will find the six ProcGen Arcana options, which are all integrated. So if you create a realm, if you generate one, it will generate cities, villages, and like it goes all the way down. It'll also generate like dangerous sites, which if you click on the dangerous sites and look into those, it'll take you to the random dungeon generator and it'll have randomly generated a dungeon for that site. If you click on the city, it'll show you the randomly generated city. And then you can click on buildings in the city or districts in the city, which will show you the specific districts, which you can then click on the buildings in the districts that then show you layouts of the mansions based on that. And similarly, if you go to villages, you can also click on the buildings and it'll show you layouts based on the mansion generator.
Yeah, and there are a bunch of other ones on the Wadaboo itch page, including a tiny pub generator, lighthouse generator, dwellings generator, which is nice. It's like floor plans for the interior of buildings. Even ProcGen locomotives, can generate your own trains. That's so funny that we both came at this with one of the exact same creators in our notes.
But yeah, all that to say, I created a map using the Realm Proc Gen Arcana generator, which, like, I used. I flipped through the generator for a bit until I had a region that sort of looked like I wanted, and then I got rid of some dangers, placed some dangers in some specific places, and then, like, set down a few more villages, which is an option. Like, you can just click around and say, like, add danger, add village, add city, that sort of thing.
Well, big shout out to Wadaboo. Turns out we love your work.
It's a funny question, is that, you know, when you're running a game of paid, like a paid game of a role-playing game, I'm gonna have to look into this more, like, how legit your assets need to be, right? Like, I don't really, I definitely don't want to use AI art, because who knows how people are gonna react to that stuff.
Yeah, people got some real opinions on that.
But, like, in addition to that, like, I'm also thinking, like, I'm probably not going to use just, like, internet, like, art that I've ripped off the internet either. I'm probably going to stick to, like, I don't know, free assets on Roll20 or something. Mm. With the exception of the stuff that I am able to generate, like, stuff that I create on Dungeon Draft, stuff that I create on Proc Gen Arcana.
I feel like stuff that you actually purchase would be valid, right?
It's true. I think that, like, if I had asset packs on Roll20, I could use those. But, like,
well, yeah, you know what, Tom? I got another thing to talk about that relates to my side of the show. This isn't an RPG, but this is something created by Nate Treme of Highland Paranormal Society. And this is just something that I noted on their profile that I thought you'd find fun and cool, which is free mini assets that you can print out if you want to make paper minis for the hateful gods of Quarkoza. It's just like 9 weird eldritch gods, and it's name your price. So you can download that for free and use these weird gods if you so desire. But I love the designs of all of these. There's some real fun, strange looking dudes here.
There are still like the only remaining stuff of Bandit Camp, as far as I can tell, the creators of Wicked Ones, is up on Roll20 as assets. They have the sandbox maps and little assets, like art assets from the book. But I find they're kind of pricey. They're like $5 a pack, and each pack does not even like there are separate packs for a number of the different like adventurer art, for example.
And, you know, I would actually be hesitant to buy those anyway, because if Bandit Camp Games is gone, like, where does that money go?
Yeah, who knows?
Like, does that just go out into the ether, or what? Is it even possible to purchase them? I wonder if you tried to purchase them, if it would just bounce back, and you wouldn't be able to actually get to the purchase page. Anyway, all that to say, I do think that there are a lot of paid or free resources that are available on, like, itch.io that you could, I'm sure you could use those. Something I know I've said on the show before when we were talking about
have misspoken, though. I think I did them dirty and said that the adventurers are not all in one pack. I think they are. So never
mind. Oh, okay.
Oh, never mind. They're in two packs. So,
Anyway, something I know I've said before on this show is, you know, don't be afraid to use the existing resources. There's so many, like, source books and world books. Like, if you were running a campaign that was really just, like, a reskinning of an existing campaign module, I don't think there'd be anything wrong with that, even if you're choosing to charge people to play in your game, because you're still putting it all together and running the game and doing the work. So I feel like prefab assets that exist online, especially obtained through legitimate means from actual artists, I think that all that's fair game. And I also definitely get your hesitancy to use anything AI related. Man, this Wadaboo, there's some great generators on here. I'm just clicking away generating tiny pubs. There's a tiny pub called the Red Gate. Here's one called the Griffin's Plow. The Miner's Arms. Here's one called the Red Bee. The Stone. I love the Stone. It's just a teeny little, like, one-room pub called the Stone.
Okay.
We haven't even talked about what's on your side of the show, Tom. What are you bringing? More Coyote's Aegis, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, we were right in the middle of, like, one of the final operations of Coyote's Aegis. We know that's right. The Demon Lord Gratz is holed up in a castle in the mantle. And so, you know, the forces of the Draelic army are moving in on all sides. But resistance is fierce. The city is full of demons. And so, like, they're having to do it sort of one stage at a time. They secure the, like, a north main street, an eastern main street, a western main street. They secured their supply line. An agent came forward, or possibly a soldier, and said that they had heard that there were infants inside the castle, and they were like, we gotta save the infants. What's going on here? What dastardly deed have they done? And what that was about where we left off. And then the players, you know, doing all the meat, there's an Underdark passage into the city that would be quite beneficial if their army would be able to use it. So the players have to secure that. And then there is also the mummy of Jill Robfling, the ancestor of Professor Nesne and Robfling, the dwarf. This mummy is needs to be put to rest.
Mother.
Okay.
Yeah, they gotta put the mummy to rest. Are they gonna do it? Do they do it, Tom?
Yeah, of course they do it. Yeah. What do you want from me?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they don't do it. Maybe the mummy gets away. There's always the chance.
Man, these players, man, they're real thorough. Which I guess I'm grateful for. I like that they, you know, eat up all that content that I put out in front of them.
So do we start there, or do you want, like, a little amuse-bouche before we get into it?
No, I'll jump right into it.
Go for it.
So, after being told about this strange objective, which, like, I think the players are, like, infants. What do you... Sounds like potential demonic trickery to me. Although, I said the players, it's just Alex, it's just my brother. So, his judgment, you know, probably, suspicious, you know? What do you think? You're in the middle of a battle with a city infested with demons. It used to be a city run by humans, human supremacists, though. Although, you know, the babies probably don't, like, aren't racist yet. How do you handle that situation? How do you take that news, McGill?
What, that the city that I'm fighting to defend is full of bigots?
No. You're you're on the attacking side. You are part of the Draelic army.
Yeah.
You're charging into a city that's overrun with demons, but it used to be full of human supremacists, and you hear that there are infants being, like, held in the castle in the city. How do you take that news?
Well, we can't have that. That seems like the kind of heroic daring do that my party engages in all the time. Time to save them babies.
But you aren't suspicious that maybe it's like a baby bait trap for some demons?
You know, I'd probably sooner suspect that the demons were like gathering the infants for some horrible ritual.
Ah, well, there you go. All the more reason to rush to that objective as soon as possible. But first, so each of these little side objectives, as I said last time, also, just a shout out, this is based on, I'm going to look it up just to be sure. Assault on Maramidra. Of the Adventurers League third season, the final adventure. And so each of these little side objectives, or not side objectives, but like each of these objectives in securing the way into the city is sort of connected to a different NPC that helps out. Last time we saw it was the supply line that they were securing, and we saw that Queen Issa, the Myconid, had supplied a number of Myconids to help with the supply line. When it was the western way into the city, into the inner city, when the Umber Hulks attacked, they were getting support from their allies from Crystal Guard, who are the elves from the back of the Arctopus. So even they were taking part in this battle. When when they were taking on the defensive position where the enemies were like hidden in the mud and there was a bunch of orcs and stuff, they were getting assistance from the Drow. And when it was the northern point of entry, which was the gateway that had the masks that like shot fire at them and stuff, that were built into the wall, they were getting support from just the Draelic army. So didn't really pay attention to that one. This time, for this Underdark passage, the thing is that they are going to have to go down through like a flooded passage, and they're going to need to swim. And so for their ally support, they are joined by those Illithids that call themselves they of the Den. These are the ones that respect Gent so much for killing the Illithid and taking the rod and all that stuff. They have a sort of representative named Dab Dub, who basically offers to give the players a sort of... This is also from the module. It's like there's Illithid allies who offer to like basically give the players like amphibious capabilities by giving them this like weird symbiote that becomes one with them, so, and it hurts at first. They become amphibious, they gain 60 feet telepath, and they gain dark vision for 30 feet, but it inflicts like 5 rounds of agony basically.
It seems like a fair trade.
The players did not go with that. The players went with more traditional magic means of, water breathing and whatnot. However, deep in the flooded crevice under the Underdark, in the ruins below, they discovered lurking there an aboleth. The Illithids had sensed something dark and terrible lurking down there, but there's a freaking Aboleth down there. Not only that, but the demons had sent down some of those like mutant fire giants to inspect what was down there, and now those fire giants, dummies that they are, they've been enthralled by the Aboleth. So the Aboleth has like fire giant thralls that can attack the players on its behalf while they have to fight an Aboleth.
Damn.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. Yeah, they could have got out of this fight if they offered the Aboleth 100 slaves.
They just have to make the offer? They don't actually have to deliver?
I think that they do have to deliver. They would have like sacrifice 100 people out of the army just to like feed the Aboleth.
Ah, yeah, no deal.
Yeah, exactly. Like you can't trust the Aboleth. Yeah, man. So they take down that Aboleth, you know. Same as spoiler alert, this mummy that they're about to face. So getting deeper into the city before they head in to like face the main forces of the mantle, they split off to the catacombs, where deep inside they encounter the mummy Jill Robfling, while assisted this time by drow clerics of Aphrodite, who were brought in, I mentioned last time, from Chessie. Chessie had managed to bring in some clerics of Aphrodite who were like blade dancers. They're based on the servants of Elistrae. Do you know this drow? The chaotic good drow goddess of beauty, song, dance, all her art pictures. So she's like naked and stuff.
New deity on me.
Ha. You said new deity, but it sounded like nude deity to me, and yeah, she is, like, pretty much every time.
Oh, she's fully nude. All right.
Almost every time. Anyways, instead of her, I had them be worshippers of Aphrodite, but same deal. Like, a bunch of weird, chaotic, good, like, beauty drow clerics. So they joined in to help with the fight with the mummy lord, Jill Robfling, the mummy lady, I suppose you'd say, who is mounted on a nightmare and has lair actions. Again, this is an encounter from the module, but this is one of the only times I've seen this. I, like, had to look into this so much. It's like... Okay, I'm gonna look this up. Mummy Lord. 5e. Mummy Lord. Vulnerability, fire. Okay? Nightmare. 5e. Immunity, fire. Confer fire resistance. The nightmare can grant fire resistance, or resistance to fire damage, to anyone riding it. So if you're vulnerable to fire damage, but then fire resistance is conferred onto you, how does fire damage add up on you, McGill?
This is like a I didn't expect a pop quiz. Give me the full question again.
Okay. The mummy lord is vulnerable to fire damage, but the mummy lord is riding a nightmare. Nightmares are immune to fire damage and have the ability to confer fire resistance, which means they can grant resistance to fire damage to anyone riding it.
So the mummy has but the mummy is immune.
No, the mummy is vulnerable.
The nightmare is immune and can impart resistance to its rider.
Yeah. It's okay, not so as important that the nightmare is immune. It's mainly important that the mummy, basically, when they take fire damage, they take double damage. But then if they have...
So they just take normal damage.
Like, this is the thing, is I had to look it up, and there's some argument about, like, which kicks in first. And, like,
yeah,
I guess
you...
basically, but, man, what a... Like, I've never seen anything like that in D&D, and it's, like, in a published module.
Do you play Magic the Gathering, Tom?
Nope.
No?
I think we've talked about this. I don't play Magic the Gathering.
Have you ever played Magic the Gathering?
Not really, no.
Okay. So, in Magic the Gathering, there's this really handy thing called the stack. Have you heard of this?
Not really.
So in Magic, you are playing cards, and in the game of Magic, you are allowed to play a card in response to a different card someone's played. So I play a card, and you can say, in response to that, I'm playing a different card. And I can respond to your card, and you can respond to that. There can be as many different responses to card plays as we have the ability to play cards, like number of cards in our hands, as much mana as we have to cast cards. But the way it works is the stack then resolves from top to bottom. When you're playing cards, you're basically building a stack of cards, one on top of another. I played a card, you played a card in response to it, I played a card in response to yours, you played a card in response to mine, and then once we're done responding to each other's plays, we go from the top to the bottom, and that's the order that the different card effects kick in. And this can lead to some very funny situations, like somebody could cast a card that's going to deal damage to one of my creatures, but then I play a card that responds to that by returning my creature to my hand, and then they play a card that's a counterspell. And so the way it resolves is, you know, their counterspell counters my spell, so my creature doesn't go to my hand, so it takes the damage from them as we go down the stack of cards. And this is a case where it kind of feels like D&D needs the equivalent of the stack. We need to know which order the different effects and damage types and resistances kick off in. But D&D's got no stack.
So, I mean, spoiler alert, they do beat this mummy, but interesting enough that the mummy is on the back of a nightmare, and so there's a weird damage cancel out thing going on. And then also fighting against a bunch of ghosts, I think. Or did... You know, it's tricky sometimes. Sometimes I write ghost, and I'm like, did I write ghost or did I write ghast? Because they're both different monsters in D&D, you know? Then we head into the inner mantle. I basically just got, like, the whole city laid out for them. I have them, like, fight through, like, they have a big fight in the... I wonder. It says arena here, but did I have a big fight in the arena? Or was there just a bunch of big fighting and there was an arena there? It's a bit hard to tell. But basically, you know, they have to fight their way to the castle. But on their way, they get a new side quest. They get information from Al-Samasath, not from Al-Samasath. Someone informs them basically that Al-Samasath and the Drow Zeth have been captured by a vampiric Drow death priestess. Another one of these, like, drow death priest enemies that I've plagued the characters so much. There's been one that survived, and they have captured two VIPs, and the players now have to rescue them. Oh yeah, they get that objective from Chessie. Chessie races to them and like is like, "Oh my god, they've been captured. We gotta save them." However, then another Draelic soldier comes to them and is like, "There's like a horde of night goblins coming that like we have no idea where they came from. They're just like pouring out of the forest, and like we're getting attacked to our flank all of a sudden." And so suddenly there's
just
two,
like, this is relentless, man. The enemies are just seemingly endless force in this one.
Yeah. I mean, there's a demon lord right there in the castle.
You were just, again, you were just playing this. It was you and Alex, right?
Yeah.
Was every time a new enemy force appeared, was Alex just like, "Oh my god, and them too?"
Oh, man. I mean, I don't have the transcript, but...
Because I absolutely would be. I'd be just like, "Oh, my God, and goblins as well? Jeez.
Yeah,
what's next?"
And not just regular goblins, but mutant night goblins. There's a huge mutant army pouring into the city. And also, like, all these crazy things, like these huge tentacles come sweeping through the army. There's black ooze all over the place. The place is like being bombarded by some sort of radioactive ooze, like slime blasts. So this is all happening. Swarms of demons. It's chaos. They get through that, and then they get to the point where they have to face Isabel, the drow, who is the drow vampire priestess who has captured Al and Zeth. And Al and Zeth are being, like, drained by, like, demonic forces, basically. Or not demonic forces, but, like, death forces. Like, on round 6, Zeth would be dead. On round 11, Al Samisath would be dead. And the only thing that could bring them back would be a wish spell. But the players did manage to break their shadowy chains in time and free them, saving them from death. And also, when they... defeated the vampire priestess. At one point, she attempted to get away, but then Valfarine Draglin guy showed up, put her, like, just was like, "No vampires getting away today, blah," and it's like, destroyed her.
Well, damn. I mean, that's pretty typical of Valfarine Draglin guy.
Yeah, but we haven't seen him in a while. It's nice to see him pop up in this battle. Doing his part. This is such a crazy thing. I'm gonna look into the module for this because I think I wanna give a shout out to the actual original material for this. So I'm doing it so that the city is being attacked by this army of mutant night goblins. And do you remember what a night goblin is?
Oh god, I'm gonna get them confused with, what was it, dust goblins was the other one that you were quizzing me about at the same time. I just remember them being in tandem with the dust goblins and the whole quiz that I now forgot.
A night goblin is a goblin that is like loyal to the Night Side Eclipse,
right?
That has been living in the Deathlands and still swears loyalty to the Night Side Eclipse.
But a dust goblin is the same thing without the loyalty to the Night Side Eclipse. They
exactly.
live in the Deathlands. Yeah.
So there's this monster that the characters that the players then have to face alongside all these like demons and this huge mass of mutant goblins. And this monster they have to fight is called the Mother. So it's sort of in the module, there's sort of like a foreshadowing, like, okay, so part four of the module is a surprise visit from Mother. And it starts, the Darrow, so not goblins, but Darrow, the Darrow of Ravaged Stone have spent the last few months gathering food and nurturing their new leader, Mother, a monstrous spawn of Gratz. Mother represents all worst aspects of Gratz's connections with hunger and fecundity. Now that the crazed Darrow have fed her to the bursting, she returns to her father bursting with her children and ready to unleash them upon the world. So there's this horrible, giant, bloated mother demon that is spawning all these mutant goblins. And in part five, they face the Mother in a chapter in the module called Mommy Dearest, which goes, the Mother, spawn of Gratz and an unknown, unspeakable creature, has been in the care of the Darrow of Ravaged Stone since the Dark Prince's arrival in the Underdark. Fed on the fungus of Spordome, the corpses of Myconids, and any Darrow that wandered too close, Mother grew and grew. Once her fecundity had reached its peak, she rallied the crazed Darrow who had grown to worship her, and she has come to find her father and gift him with his many new children.
You know, we were talking earlier about using music in our adventures, and I would have been seriously tempted to put on Mother by Glenn Danzig.
There are different reads on how this goes, depending which part of the module players are coming from. But basically, it always comes to this point. Hundreds of Darrow kneel prostrate with their backs towards you and their faces pressed to the ground. With a repeated chants of Mother, they worship a revolting mass of demonic flesh who sits upon a pile of chitinous eggs. Vaguely feminine in form, the demonic creature has three massive horns on each side of her head, and several tentacles flail out of a wide horizontal furrow in her abdomen just below her chest. A snake-like tongue darts out and grabs one of the Darrow, who dies screaming into her gargantuan fanged maw, while a large bird creature claws its way free of the furrow, birthing slime oozing off the vile thing as it shakes free. That being a vrock that has just spawned out of her weird birthing orifice. And so, yeah, I had the players fight that as it was spawning demons and surrounded by insane mutant goblins.
So many bad guys. I mean, I already said it, but I would just be kind of overwhelmed to be in this adventure, just going like, and there's more and more of them. Now there's a mummy riding a nightmare, and now there's goblins.
But once the Mother is defeated and the night goblins have been scattered at the destruction of their mother.
Mother.
Yeah.
Mommy Dearest module doesn't have a mummy in it? It just has this mother?
No, it does. Both things are in. This module is called Assault on Maramidra.
Right.
Man, where is the part with the mummy?
So just the section is called Mommy Dearest, not the whole module.
No. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Got it.
The friendly dead in part two, the initial assault, That is the part with the mummy. And you get support from clerics of Eliastria. And, yeah. The mummy is called Vragni instead of Jill Robling. Some names have been changed for my campaign. So then, players have to infiltrate the castle. First, they meet with a group of, MPOC and Draelic VIPs. Coyote, Chessie, Alistair, Spymaster D, who's from, Coyote, their boss of Coyote's Aegis. Chessie, we remember Chessie from Al's Aces, and she's in charge of Chessie's Cupids, the matchmaking mm-hmm. program. Alistair, who is from MPOC's Finest and is the cleric, or not cleric, warlock of Mephisto. Spymaster D, who is the the spy master for the city of Crystal Guard on the back of the Arctopus for the elves. Then we have an orc representative of the Draelic army, I believe, named Keg. We have Queen Issa, the Myconid leader. Al-Samaseth, who they just saved. Zeth, who they just saved. Professor Nesne and Rob Fling. Morgwar, the orc, We've had trouble about his rank before. I've called him like Sergeant Morgwar, but then sometimes he's like Commander Morgwar. The point is, he's like.
Actually be on our WordPress. I think I may have noted it there.
Oh wow!
Maybe I didn't though. I might be lying, but I definitely remember not only having that that quandary come up of Morgar's rank, but then also noting it down when I edited that episode, and of course it's completely gone from my brain now.
And finally, Trey, their Illithid sentient resources officer, who I have in brackets here. If Al-Samaseth survived his capture earlier, Trey is in a state of concern. Now, why might that be?
Why might it be of concern to Morgar?
No, why might Trey be concerned, and it's dependent on Al-Samaseth being alive?
Oh, gosh. I'm starting to feel, Tom, like I've got to keep a campaign notebook the way the way your players might. I'm still just trying to keep track of all of the different enemy forces in this. I don't know. Well, why?
Because why the concern? Al-Samaseth is secretly a minister.
Oh, yes, of course. So I did know that, but I didn't know that that was the reason in this present moment.
We're getting ever closer to the reveal.
Man, you set that up so long ago.
Yeah.
Did you set that up in the previous campaign even?
I did first introduce the idea that, like, ministers might infiltrate the MPOC
in
the previous campaign. And I've had six members of the MPOC quietly be ministers throughout this whole campaign, and they don't get revealed until, like, very soon.
So, those... I must commend your forward thinking when it comes to these extremely long-term twists, especially this one, like Al-Samaseth and the ministers and all that. Do you get like a certain kind of thrill out of the reveal of those things? Is this one of those things where it's like you just live to see the looks on your players' faces when they get blindsided by these reveals?
I definitely, like, really enjoyed the payoff of the reveal when, like, they found Odium and I finally mm-hmm. revealed that Odium was, like, basically responsible for the creation of the Nightside Eclipse. Like, that was such a cool payoff that like I'd been building to for so long. And
you find your players always, they tend to respond well to these kinds of twists?
I think so.
Right on.
It certainly keeps things interesting for me.
It's the longevity. It is the degree to which you plan ahead for these twists that I find pretty impressive. And I can't help but sort of contemplate it in practice. I almost feel like if I tried to do something like that, I would forget the twist long before we got to the reveal.
So I have a ton of stuff about the castle here. But for all of that, I don't entirely know how the players like infiltrated the castle in the end. I have a check mark over a DC 23 perception check, and it says slash fly, but I don't know if they flew or what. Point is, they get into the castle. The castle in which Gratz themselves, the freaking demon lord, is hanging out somewhere. Probably. Where would you guess in the castle is Gratz hanging out?
Usually it's either the very top or the very bottom.
It's the highest point, of course.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's even true in the module, but
it's just obvious, right? It's always the top or the topmost level or the bottommost level. Maybe even just for practical purposes, you put the big boss at the very end. The very last spot that they wind up, always the top or the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the last thing listed, so whatever. But it's also should be said, it's like, it's not like me and my brother did all of this in like one session. Like, we probably had a session where it was just fighting the mother. So we go through the whole castle. Whole meat. There was also, man, I think, was it Alsamathath? Excuse me. Alsamathath? Someone went in with them when they went into the castle. I can't remember who. But someone, yeah. I'm pretty sure it was a goblin. And I, so like, it's probably either Alsamathath or Coyote, and I don't think it was Coyote, so I think it was probably Alsamathath. Whatever the case, first point in the castle, they find a very extravagant, luxurious room where there are a bunch of demons lounging around. There's a Glabrezu that I believe even in the module is called Bextron. They are smoking from a hookah, which I just turned into a big old bong. And, if you smoke from it, you get high for 1 hour and you have to save versus madness. There's the option to like bribe the demons, with drugs or booze or a magic item, and get information from them. But the players didn't do any of that. The players just attacked the demons and defeated them. Rescuing their captive drow servant was actually a drow VIP they'd been warned about before, and who basically gave them intel about the portals that were located throughout the castle, which has like the building that the castle is built on that is in the module has a very bizarre kind of layout. It's called the Undying Temple, and it is like partially in the ethereal realm and partially not, and it has like this sphere of baleful energy in the center of it. It's very hard to explain. But I guess we can just summarize as saying, like, well, they ascended. They ascended the castle. They fought a Cambion in demon armor, which gave them access to demon armor. And by defeating the Cambion, he was accompanied by a bunch of Nightside Eclipse elite. But once the Cambion was defeated, the Nightside Eclipse just fled, because they don't have a stake in this fight. This is like a demon operation now. Nightside Eclipse don't want anything to do with this.
How many sessions did you say this was?
Oh, I have no idea.
So many.
Countless.
Literally countless. You didn't count.
There's a point where the players can find the quarters of the Cambion, and this is also in the module. Actually, I think I'm gonna pull it up from the module right here. The read aloud description is a four poster bed with garish silks dominates the room. Several extremely realistic mannequins of drow females and one male quaggoth are posed in fanciful costumes around the bed. A number of furs are piled in a corner. The Cambion resides here. Those who inspect the mannequins with a DC 15 intelligence investigation realize that they are not mannequins at all, but rather real people that have been stuffed. Realizing this horrific taxidermy forces a DC 10 wisdom madness saving throw. Those that fail gain a level of madness. And, so yeah.
Did they succeed?
I think so. But like, you know, every time it would have to be like a bunch of them whenever they have to save versus madness. Although I think actually only one person recognized this, and it was probably like Hexaquila, who was like, eh, this doesn't bother me. So looking at the module, I'm reminded, and this is actually something pretty cool that I kind of want to make a shout out to. Speaking of long building payoffs, one of the reasons I had a character traveling with them through the castle is because in the module there is a character that joins them as they go into the place. Like they basically teleport up to where they need to get into this place, but then are immediately joined by this like little girl who has a pet goat. And this like weird little girl with this pet goat, she has actually shown up ever since season one of the Adventurers League. She's just like this mysterious little girl who comes from this weird village. She first appears in this weird village that has like a demonic possession problem and or some sort of demon related problem back in the first season. So this would have been, I would have run it as like an Adventurers as an Al's Aces operation. I think I adapted it to be one of the things that they did back when they were in Cania, the hell that Mephisto reigns over. So I think I probably had it just be like some weird imp that was following them around. But in the Adventurers League, in these adventures, there's this girl named Elisande and her goat. And Elisande has been showing up mysteriously throughout the Adventurers League for a while now. And then in this module, it's sort of like the big payoff in this huge boss fight module against Gratz, she suddenly makes an appearance and then like follows you through the area. And like, so when you go into the room that has the hookah, Elisande goes over and tries to smoke from the hookah, but it makes her dizzy and she falls over and vomits. She crawls over to the alcohol to wash her mouth out and then offers the ball to one of the characters as she does not like it. in the room with the taxidermy, Elisande dances around with the Quaggoth mannequin as though it were a fuzzy doll. She asks if one of the characters will carry it home for her. So I remember, like, I had sort of, like, I sort of represented these things by having the, I think it was Al-Samisath, the goblin that was with them, be, like, acting just kind of weird and, like, doing things inexplicably like Elisande does. I remember Alex being like, man, can we like fucking focus? Like, this is a big operation. Like, everybody pull it together. Like, what are you doing?
Wait, shit. Am I supposed to focus? Did I not focus enough?
So... continuing up through the castle.
There you are. Okay.
Nope. There's a trap door. There's Bexron's room, who's the Glabrezu that they faced in the room with the hookah. And his room's got 500 gold worth of drugs in it, according to my notes. They end up going through a bunch of floors where there is like terrible abyssal heat pouring through that like makes them have to save versus fire damage pretty much. That was pretty oppressive as just like a passive effect. They run into a couple of drunk Nightside Eclipse that are hanging out in the castle who just, like, immediately surrender. They pass through a torture room. They find the room with the abyssal portal that's outputting so much heat. I think one of them actually did try to interact with the portal, which is, like... makes you save against a huge amount of fire damage, and also have to save against going mad, which they did, according to my notes here. They're mainly at this point, they're just like racing from floor to floor. They're like, they keep hitting floors that are just like so unbearably hot that they're like, all right, next floor, next floor, next floor. Like, just getting through it as quickly as possible until they finally come to the nursery, in which there are 12 demon babies.
Oh, that's what it is.
They're all half-demon babies, though. So there's a half-demon drow baby, there's a half-demon goblin baby, there's half-demon fire giant babies. Imagine how big those babies are. Half-demon orc babies.
That's a big baby.
They're all being taken care of by a succubus that I named Cherry. And so Cherry is watching over all the demon babies. I'll read the thing out of the module, actually, because it's pretty cool. So the read aloud text is a combination of cooing and high-pitched wails greets you as the door opens. A dozen cribs fill the room, each with a monstrous infant. An attractive woman with red eyes wearing a short white robe holds a drow baby. The baby's tail flicks back and forth as it offers a flamed smile. And the succubus says, "Do you want to hold him? Be careful. He's started teething." So, yeah. They... they did move to rescue the demon babies. I think there's a thing in the module about how basically if you try to attack the succubus that's taking care of the babies, she tries to use her etherealness ability to swap to the other plane and flee, and then she appears later in the final fight with Gratzt if she's escaped. I can't remember exactly how that shook out. It's possible that, according to my notes, that she may have made it to the final fight. There's a whole thing in the module about how Elisande, the little girl, chooses a specific character in the party who, like, they are like romantically infatuated with, basically, that they have a crush on. So in the notes here it says Elisande is fascinated by the babies and she pokes them to make them cry, which she finds funny. She's not especially interested in killing them, however. Elisande likes the succubus unless her chosen warrior flirts with her. Then she wants them dead. There's also a secret mission in the module from the Zentarim faction, which sort of inspired my whole thing about the one soldier saying that there were infants in the castle and we have to get them out and whatnot. The Zentarim faction, though, for their own goals, they want at least one of these demonic children recovered alive so that they can, like, be trained to be a member of the Zentarim.
So what happened next?
Well, on the next level, they had to fight through a bunch of super mutant guards, those giant fire, half demon blooded fire giant mutant guards. And after fighting through them, they were protecting the room of the fire giant daughter of Gratzt, who was appointed to become queen of Agaloc, or at least the mantle, once his dominion was complete. I had her be named Queen Dizzy, and so they burst into Queen Dizzy's room, but all they find is another one of these super mutant guards. They find a portal that basically is like a portal into Drail. And then there is like, so there's kind of a cool thing in this module where before they hit the final the final battle, there is a room, a vestry. The read aloud description is: the walls of this room are covered with pegs, some of which have thin red silk robes or gold necklaces with a clawed six-fingered hand. And so it says Gratz minions store ceremonial robes and necklaces here, putting them on before entering into the temple above. The necklace radiates magic and make the wearer immune to the poison in the symbol of Gratz in the next level, but give the wearer disadvantage to saving throws made to resist Crown of Madness or Dissonant Whispers spells cast by Gratz while within the area. Elisande puts on one set of robes and a necklace and dances around. The robe is massively large on her and she has trouble walking in it. She tries to put a robe on the goat, but it runs around the room, preventing her from doing so unless the characters help corral it.
You know, ever since I fell in love with and ran multiple times that adventure from Dungeon Magazine called, oh, what was it called? It's the one with Amelia Amanitas. It's a Wizard Tower adventure. I know I have absolutely mentioned it in the past. The name is escaping me now, but there's a key feature of that where there is like a cloakroom and one of the hooks activates a secret elevator. Now, whenever as a player I am in any kind of cloakroom or vestry, My inclination is to see if any of those hooks open any secret rooms. You know, the secret hallway behind the coats.
But man, I just realized how long I've been going, and we should definitely break here.
Okay.
Just before the final battle, which we'll talk about next time.
All right. Well, I guess that means we're heading to the RPG Danger
Room.
Good excuse to play that theme song.
Yes.
And as I said off the top, I'm just talking about a whole bunch of stuff by Highland Paranormal Society. And the person behind it is this person, Nate Treme. And there's just so much great stuff here. It's hard for me to even know where to begin, but begin I shall. And I'm gonna start with just something that's sort of on the silly side. Nate does a lot of like one page or mini RPGs or, you know, mini supplements. The longest RPG module or game that I've seen from Nate has been 9 pages, I think. They're all pretty bite-sized. And I'm going to start with one of the sillier ones that I came across, which is Brim and Feather.
All right.
So actually, I know I sent you the PDF for this. It is free to download, but did you look at it? You don't have to look at it.
I just saw it in the package that you...
Okay,
that
so
you
don't look at it yet. Don't look at it yet. Since this is one page and free, I have no qualms about just like reading out the 3 paragraphs. But I want to get your running thoughts as I go through this. So, Brim and Feather. You are members of the Wandering Order of Fallen Stars. The Order's hierarchy is determined by wideness of hat brim or length of feather in hat. Feather length beats brim width every time. So, the longer the feather, the more likely you are to be at the top of the hierarchy of the Wandering Order of Fallen Stars. Here's what you do. Meet once a month in a garden or park. Determine hierarchy. The winner, called the Crow Righteous and Supreme, leads the others on a tour through the park or garden. A song, poem, or unrecorded history lesson is customary. Do not speak to trees unless the sky is overcast. The journey must end somewhere with a meal available. The Crow Righteous and Supreme covers any costs. Repeat every month. Keep record of how many times each member is Crow Righteous. This is not a game, and it never ends. Do not speak to the trees unless the sky is overcast. Do not be sorry.
This is goofus.
Yeah, that's I just threw that one in there because it's silly. The part I love that it's laid out. It's like a punchline. You get to the very end and it goes, "This is not a game and it never ends." Especially after they indicate that maybe you should be keeping score. You know, keep records of how many times each member is Crow Righteous. But this is not a game and it never ends. You just wear funny hats with your friends, and each month someone. Whoever has the widest hat or longest feather is declared to be the leader, and they gotta lead the group around the park, talking, you know, a song, a poem, a history lesson, and then they treat everybody to a meal. And then you do it all again the next month. I think that's pretty funny. That is not exemplary of the kinds of cool stuff that Nate Treme makes. I know I sent you... Mount Zorgoth. Why don't you open that one up? Mount Zorgoth is a one-page dungeon with a really like nice graphic design presentation to it. Love the... It reminds me a lot of our friend Grant. That great sort of style to it.
Hell yeah.
And this is a one-page dungeon. After centuries in cold, clouded darkness, brave adventurers climb the mountains to bring sunlight back to their people. Unless the PCs can fly, the mountains must be traveled in numerical order. And then it goes down mountains 1 through 9. There is a map with all the different mountains indicated. and all the different places that you can go, and each location has like just a little blurb about it. So I'll read a couple of them. I'm not going to go through all nine of them, but to give you a sampling, like the first mountain, the adventurers break through the perma clouds. Zorgoth, the Cyclops godling, rules from the highest peak. His star magic keeps the world below shrouded in darkness. Can the spell be broken? And then there's a random encounters table for areas 1 and 2. You got a D4 on you?
Oh, I can have 1.
So Slug Shepherd, who is only hostile if his flock of very hostile 2d4 spider goats are attacked. So you arrive on the first mountain, and there's a Slug Shepherd herding spider goats. The spider goats are aggressive and hostile towards you. And then, you know, role play the scene, you can move on. Mountain 2, the earth spirit living in this mountain will grant luck, a free reroll, to all party members if they revert the boiling licorice flow from the blue volcano, which is mountain number 4, to its previous cool temperature. So, you know, you got 9 locations like that. There are a couple of random tables. There's one merchant, the rusty merchant bot. They tell you his inventory. He's got, you know, a magic bean, a vial of jelly hawk scent, and a 50-foot goat spider sticky rope. What can I say? I love this. What a nice little freebie. Well designed. It's got some really fun flavor. You could fit this into a lot of different settings. You know, this could be a fantasy one, but this could also be like a funny post-apocalyptic, or maybe even some kind of weird Scavenger's Reign style future setting. Almost reminds me of like Samurai Jack, both visually and in terms of like the funny things you encounter. Like, you know, a rusty merchant bot and a slug merchant and then an earth god. If you're in areas 6 or 7A, you might encounter outcast fishfolk bandits or an angry sponge ogre. Pretty cool. I love it. What do you think of this? This is a neat little dungeon.
It's a great one-page dungeon. I love it.
Yeah. And Nate's got a lot of fun little one-page things here. Some are free. Some cost a bit of money. Here's one that you pay for. It's a one-page dungeon for 5th edition D&D. It's called In God's Green Earth. I guess it's not one page. It's a 12-page PDF with a dungeon map and then like all the stuff that goes in the dungeon, and it's all vegetation themed, which is pretty neat. I love the isometric layout. You can get just like a little sample of the bestiary: attack vines, cabbage babies, corn people, tomato hounds, potato boy, which is pretty funny because I call my cat Bruce Potato Boy. I'll get to that one in a second, but there's just loads of stuff like this and loads of little like single page RPGs as well, and other mini ones. Like another one that I sent you that is only 4 pages long is this one called Tunnel Goons, an analog adventure game for nice people. This is one where there is a referee. And the rules, it's just like, it's such a sweet, basic little thing, you know? When an action success is uncertain, a player rolls 2d6 and adds the score from the relevant ability. And there's a difficulty score guideline. Easy is 8, moderate is 10, hard is 12. Dangerous actions, there's rules for inventory and death. Abilities are brute, skulker, and erudite. Basically meaning like force, I guess strength, dex, and combination of charisma and intelligence. Character creation rules are very, very simple. There are some D6 tables that you can roll on to determine your starting ability scores and gear. Maybe you're a slab dragger. Maybe you're a desert urchin who became a pit warden and went underground. lots of different options there. And then just a character sheet that you could fit on a cue card. You know, I'm a fan of these like stripped down compact little RPGs. But all of the stuff that Nate put out for free, it's all sort of like that stuff. It's either a slick dungeon or just sort of a stripped down, straightforward RPG. Actually, before I talk about one of the more elaborate ones that I sent, the one that took me down this rabbit hole, I'll show you one more of these one-page RPGs. This one's called Mecha Dudes. I want to know what you think of Mecha Dudes, Tom. So, Mecha Dudes, this one is a one sheet. It has just a one sheet rule set that also includes your character sheet. It's all very sketchily done. It looks like it was sort of rough drafted and maybe Photoshop. Mecha Dudes, check three boxes: violence, logic, and heart. Check a heart when you get hurt. When all your hearts are checked, you're dead. You have four hearts. When an action's outcome is uncertain, roll a d6 for every checked box in a relevant stat. A 1 equals success. All players make a mecha dude. The GM runs them through an official D&D adventure that was illegally obtained. You make up the rules as needed.
Has to be illegally obtained.
This is it. This is the whole game. That's what it says. It says this is it. This is the whole game. And what do you notice about this, Tom? The thing that made me laugh out loud.
I just
would you buy this game?
It's $100.
It's $100. And that's because it was made for the Art is Ego Jam. And I can't think of anything more egotistical than this bare bones ass RPG, clearly just sort of thrown together, given away for free. Like, the whole game is here, but if you want to own it by buying it, it's going to cost you $100.
The comments are pretty good. Apparently at one point it was $50. Someone says, I think $50 is too cheap. There has been inflation since it was first published. It should be $150. And they said, well, that just makes sense.
No community copies? Pretty funny stuff. I appreciate the sense of humor. But let's talk about one that I am excited to run. And this is how I found out about it. And it's yet another one of those ones that I got with the giant RPG bundle. And it is called In the Light of a Ghost Star. And I sent you the source book for this one. And it's an RPG that does use a GM, called a referee in this case, but it doesn't require a lot of forward prep. And in fact, it discourages a lot of forward prep by saying the adventure uses a hex map. You can see the hex map there. There is no plot or story that the players must follow. As you, the referee, present the world to them and they react, a story will emerge. A blank hex map is provided if you want to plan your own adventure. You can use the location generator to help populate it. But it seems like this is one where, you know, players make their characters pretty quickly and then the map kind of guides the story. It's all sort of based on OSR rules. Character creation has three stats. In this case, it's fighter, explorer, and scientist, which again is sort of like strength, dexterity, and then a combination of intelligence, charisma, and wisdom. Characters start with 3 hit points, 10 inventory slots, and 50 credits. There's a short list of gear that you can purchase with your credits and how many inventory slots they each take up. In this case, the role that you make needs a 4 or higher to succeed. So like 4 is the number you're always aiming for, 4 or higher. There can be, you know, advantages and disadvantages assigned by the referee, +1, -1 kind of things. And the 3 stats, you assign 3 different die values to: a d4, a d6, and a d8. You can fight when you encounter monsters. And the whole point here, I'll just read sort of the little pitch on the opening page here. Earth was abandoned ages ago during the Red Giant expansion. Now, dimly lit by the ghost light of a dead white dwarf, it lies layered with aeons of forgotten civilizations. From the warmth of Martian reactor cities, scavengers hire illegal transportation to Earth to delve into its depths, looking for ancient treasures. There, they must deal with ghosts, machines, and the strange life that has evolved on humankind's abandoned home planet. You advance by acquiring treasure, basically. Treasures can be ancient Earth artifacts or ancient alien tech. If you deliver 5 treasures, you go up a level, you increase your HP by 1, you raise 1 stat die to the next size, and then gain 1 inventory slot. You can gain conditions, but really conditions like hunger, intoxication, disease, and exhaustion, they give a -1 to all rolls. So you don't have to worry too much about statuses like we were talking about with Powered by the Apocalypse. Alien artifacts are scattered around the map and they all do different things. So you can find a cool piece of alien tech. It takes up a lot of room, takes up 2 inventory slots. But you can also sell it for a bunch of credits, and you can use it. They all have a cool use. You land at the center of the hex map, and then you just... It's almost like a board game. You wander the map, and you have your encounters. Some of the hexes are labeled with a number. Those are the pre-written locations, places like Glork City, the Cybernetic Monolith, or my personal favorite, the Astro Lich's Tower.
I like the Cybernetic Monolith.
Cybernetic Monolith is pretty great too. And every time you encounter a hex, you roll to determine the weather as well. So you can get some flavor there with the weather. Maybe it has a consequence if your referee is feeling like, you know, if there's hail, maybe you have a -1 to your movement because it hurts to move. There are some NPCs that you encounter. You know, I mentioned the Astro Lich's Tower. Well, Nurgle the Astro Lich lives there, and he commands an army of humanoid cockroaches.
Nurgle the Astro Lich, that's like gut bones.
Yeah, that's true. There are warlords. They got a random Earth artifact table here you can roll on, everything from books to Twinkies to Halloween masks. And then if you encounter a hex that doesn't have a prefab location on it, you roll a random encounter and there's a nice D12 table here. Tom, you got a D12? Roll a D12.
Hell yeah. Roll a D12. Roll a D12. It's a 10.
Oh, this is the perfect one for you. You encounter 2d4 fungal star goblins, moldy-skinned aliens who travel to Earth on a wayward meteor. They have 2 hit points and deal 1 damage. Poisonous spores explode from their bodies when they die, with a 50% chance of transmitting disease. They love shiny objects and philosophy. So they're moldy-skinned star goblins, but it doesn't seem like they're actually hostile. You know, they love shiny objects and philosophy. You could probably find something in your inventory to convince them not
what
to attack
doth
you.
Doth life.
But sometimes, what am star goblin? But there are all sorts of cool encounters here. There are battle apes. There's a space whale. There's a robo-cat. There's an ancient AI hologram kiosk. Only one of the prefab locations, the Foreboding Cave, incorporates a dungeon crawl. But I guess the referee can just make up their own dungeon crawls as they see fit. But there is a pre-built dungeon, the Sunken Temple of the Whale Prophet, that is provided, and it's got, you know, looks like 9 rooms. It's got a few random tables to roll on, wandering monsters, and you can roll to see how monsters react. They provide a little grid layout that's blank to make your own dungeon crawls. And then there's also a blank hex map with multiple location generators here. Let's generate a quick location for a hex, Tom. Roll a d12.
4.
So it's a skyscraper that's somehow still standing. Roll again.
12.
Inside the ruined skyscraper is a congregation of robot monks. Roll again.
8.
The robot monks are seeking to protect their territory from strangers, so you better stay away from their ruined skyscraper. So there's a hex. I think that's pretty neat. Some good flavor there. The source book includes just a brief transcript of play. It's exactly what you'd expect from everything I described. They give you also a character sheet, and like that's the full package. That is In the Light of a Ghost Star. I love this stuff. I think this is awesome, awesome little RPG. A little bit deeper than the typical one, but not so deep that it's overly complicated. What do you think of this, Tom?
It makes me want to use that D12 like hex generator Gozer.
Oh, with Gozer, yeah. Yeah, that's pretty, that'd be fun.
Because I feel like Gozer, I don't know if anything in that like sort of simplified, almost OSR wheelhouse has appealed to me as much as Gozer.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see this totally working with Gozer. You know what my only complaint about this is, Tom? Do you know what it is?
What is it?
There's no rules for playing it solo. I think that this could make a totally fine solo RPG. You got the map, you're going around encountering stuff on the map. You got these tables, you know, you land on an empty hex, you roll a random encounter. The only part of it that does not lend itself to solo play is dungeon crawls. But that is why I was looking at that, the Wataboo dungeon generator, the one-page dungeon generator, because that resource is perfect. I totally think I'm actually going to play this as a solo journaling game at some point, because I love the flavor. I love I love the presentation on this one. This hex map is great with all its little doodles on it. All of the NPCs and the encounters, they're all really fun. They also have that sort of Samurai Jack, like sci-fi fantasy kind of a thing going on. And but yeah, if the only thing that's missing is dungeon crawls generated as needed, thankfully Wataboo provides that. Said Nate Treme also provided something of a dungeon generator that was meant to fit within The Light of a Ghost Star, but it's not really like a full dungeon generator. It's this thing called the Eternal Caverns of Urk. And it's a bunch of random tables to build dungeons out of. The Eternal Caverns of Urk also come with its own untested little RPG system that I haven't looked at yet. But the Caverns of Urk do not generate maps. That's the one downside. But they do generate flavorful caverns for you. So here, for example, I just generated one. This cavern has smooth red arches, purple giant mushrooms, and black geometric trees. It has cold black floating water orbs, and the air is sweltering and fresh. Sweltering and fresh. It's like hot, but it smells fresh. This cavern is occupied by a distrustful, rotund, horned koala with a cultural disposition for elaborate stone stacking. These are just Mad Libs. I was like generating these and I was like, oh man, this is pretty cool. But then I was like, oh man, this is also just, these are fun little Mad Libs. This cavern has sharp black floating plateaus, black cacti, and rainbow moss. It has a warm black river and the air is warm and humid. It's a very warm black place, I guess. But yeah, so the Eternal Caverns of Urk could potentially be used in conjunction with In the Light of the Ghost Star, but man, I think this is sweet stuff. What else have I got? I talked about Tunnel Goons, I talked about all this. I guess the bottom line of all of it is just get yourself over to the Highland Paranormal Society itch page, which is Nate Treme, NATETREME.itch.io. I guess it could be Natreme, itch.io, and there's so much cool stuff here. Now, apparently, Highland Paranormal Society has also created another sci-fi RPG that In the Light of a Ghost arc can kind of work in conjunction with. It's called Mothership, but that one's not offered on Itch. That one seems to be an exclusive to something else. So I may yet get to Mothership, but you can bet I'm going to be playing In the Light of a Ghost Star. Yeah. So
is that our episode?
Sure is. I mean, I could just keep going on and on about this. I just realized there's another freebie from Nate, a game called The Mephitic Laboratory of the Pescamancer. Another one-shot adventure folded into a single pamphlet with stats provided. Man, so cool. And it's all pixel art. Love this stuff. But yeah, that's it. That's our episode.
So, if you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or follow us, check us out on Facebook, Comparing Campaign on Facebook. Or if you want to see our show notes and supplemental materials, check us out on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. Sorry.
Level up.
Yeah, who's gonna get that $100 role-playing game? Not me.
Instead, you should get yourself some of these free pamphlet dungeons and one-page RPGs and level up, advance one of your dice by a single die value.
Okay. And don't steal, because it's haunted.